How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. We are also available on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. And if you want any information, you can call us at 778-782-CJSF. On this week's episode of Sustainable Futures, Ryan chats with Catherine Collette, a lifetime sustainability activist and former Green Party leader.
Everything that impinges on the environment is because of what humans are doing, trying to meet their needs in all those other areas. Mm-hmm. So they're totally linked. People who still think in terms that you save the environment and then we just carry on with our economy, mm-hmm. just do not grasp that.
And Sustainable Futures correspondent Sarah Hyde speaks to Ali Turnbull from the BC Cooperative Association about how they are getting youth engaged in environmental issues.
We've used that term again and again, you know, it'll be the grandchildren or it'll be the children who inherit the earth. And now we're at that place where it's like, here they are, you know, these young people really aware of the environmental issues from an early age.
And we learn about Wild Earth's activist roots in an interview with Zoe Blunt.
You know, it's not the same as it was 10 years ago. We don't see nearly as much action in civil disobedience and really frontline, no compromise. Rainforest preservation, and that's really unfortunate.
And of course, your weekly Streeters and Environmental News Update. I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And I'm Kim Tay.
And this is
Sustainable Futures.
So the feature interview of the day is an interview I did a while ago with Catherine Collette, who I will be calling Cholette, but I am wrong back then. I've become much wiser since that time.
Yes, a wise one. So, Ryan, your interview with Catherine Collette was actually really interesting because she spoke a lot about her personal experiences and also the studies that she's done on the environmental movement. And what I really thought was interesting is how she compared the mass mobilization that occurred in World War II or during World War II to the mass mobilization that we need to have now to start making a difference when it comes to sustainability and improving the environment.
Yes, that struck me too. I thought that was very interesting, and it shows how important a political leadership can be in actually getting things done, because it was the political will. The population was ready, but it took direct leadership from politicians to get it to happen. So now, instead of getting all keyed up for war, maybe we could get keyed up for the environment instead.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. I think that was such a powerful movement in World War II, and I don't know much about it, but I know that it was quite powerful. And to have that kind of power or empowerment, not necessarily power, but yeah, empowerment when it comes to environmental issues and sustainability, I think it would just, that would just be so amazing to have that happen. And I think that, I think eventually we'll have to get to that point.
Yeah, I think so, of course. But one thing I asked her in the interview was, is this question of the top down or the bottom up? And she had some interesting things to say about that too, because she is a former Green Party leader. Does change come from the people or does it come from the politicians? And that's really actually very much the focus of the interview for the most part. And I found her to be very approachable. She is a very good people person, and I like the way that she can surround a topic with all different points of view.
So here's the interview with Catherine Collette.
All right, so this is Ryan Fletcher here with Catherine Collette on Sustainable Futures. We're going to be talking about quite a few things today, but we'll be talking about Sustainable Cafe, sustainability, and I'm interested in asking you a bit about your time with the Green Party of Canada.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And also your alumni, when did you go to SFU?
I graduated in 87, sociology, anthropology.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah. See, I also completed a liberal studies degree downtown at Harbor Center 3 years ago.
Oh, so you've recently gone back.
Yes, yeah. I did that after being an activist for a number of years. I decided to go back.
So have you found then it helps you understand kind of the way things are?
Oh, well, it certainly helps to understand. Yes,
yeah.
I think so. Because I find that when I was very active in the Green Party, I found we had a lot of people with a scientific and technical background,
mm-hmm.
not as many with a structural background.
Mm-hmm.
And so to bring those two things together, I think, is key in sustainability. And then going back and looking at the philosophical groundings of our Western way of life
mm-hmm.
helps me to have a better grasp of that. So it's all helpful,
mm-hmm.
hugely helpful.
And what has brought you into sustainability? Have you always been interested, or where does the interest come from?
In the 60s, I was active to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to university then. I was actually showing horses, and I was active around keeping riding available, riding happening in Burnaby, because they were going to outlaw horseback riding.
Yeah.
That started me being political.
Mm-hmm.
That moved on as I left my riding behind, which I'd left in the 70s.
Yeah.
That moved on into political aspects.
So you're going for a different riding this time.
Different kind. And,
yeah.
and I also had a huge interest in health and food from the time I was young, as a teenager. I was,
mm-hmm.
And that takes you right into the entire sphere of toxins in your food, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But my main interest has always been social justice, and
mm-hmm.
sociology, anthropology were the offspins of that. Then that led me back into ecology, because they're so linked. Once you start to see the links, you realize there's just no way they can be separated.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with anthropology, all the ways that unecological living is hurting peoples all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And our effort to draw the resources to our main part of our economy.
Mm-hmm. So in anthropology, is that kind of looking at other cultures and the way they live, or what exactly is that?
Well, that's mostly what I focused on was looking at modern cultures and
mm-hmm.
other cultures, but in more modern times.
Modern times, yeah.
And that's when it becomes so apparent how heavily we've impacted on them.
Mm-hmm.
And also the other aspect, I guess, that I draw from anthropology was realizing that the whole belief system around you shapes you so hugely.
Mm-hmm.
And just how much work we have to do to try and move away
mm-hmm.
from what we've been so strongly conditioned and socialized to accept.
When you became leader of the Green Party, what kind of situation did you inherit? Like, how big was the Green Party?
Oh, it was very tiny.
Yeah.
It was very tiny. There was BC, it was quite well organized, and Ontario and all of the other provinces had only small groupings.
Mm-hmm.
And I was mainly elected by a group that included me, of course, that didn't think we should have hierarchical structures in the party. So I was
mm-hmm.
really meant to be a non-leader leader.
Right.
And I had a huge awakening because I realized through that two-year period that we would miss so many opportunities to voice our thoughts if I didn't speak out as leader when the opportunity was given to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it shifted my thinking quite a bit, because I realized that when you have a set of institutions that exist, even if you want them to progress and change, you still have to work within them and be pushing
mm-hmm.
and use them as much as you can. So
mm-hmm.
that shifted my thinking a fair amount during those 2 years. I had just so many times when I would be asked something as leader that they wouldn't bother to hear our opinion if I didn't speak.
Was it hard because people weren't there at the time? Like
mm-hmm.
you needed some kind of immediate action? Kind of thing?
Well, it was mostly the media, etc., expect the party
yeah.
to have a leader, and they just
they
are not
interested.
They
need someone to go to and ask. Yeah.
Yes, and so it was, I guess, we were a fledgling party, and we had fledgling
mm-hmm.
ideas, and ultimately, hopefully, we will have democracies that
mm-hmm.
are far more participatory and less hierarchical, but when you're not there yet,
mm-hmm.
it's very, very difficult to help people understand what you're trying to do if you just keep saying, well, I'm not speaking because we don't really want to have a leader that speaks.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what happened at that time, and so I started to
mm-hmm.
speak when people asked me.
How new was the Green Party at that time? When did it start up as a party?
Well, I joined in 84, and actually I think it started about 82.
Okay, so it was very,
very
new.
Yeah. It was very new, yes. Yeah. We were very active, though. We had a wonderful group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very active. And I look back on that time very, very specially, because it's wonderful to have a home politically.
Mm-hmm.
I left the party in 1990 because I realized that I'm actually more of a movement builder than I am trying to organize, build a party. The party has to have its foot in the political situation is at the time, and it mm-hmm. also has to be moving towards the future.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be making the compromises and trying to find the ways to talk about the economy and all of the various aspects
mm-hmm.
you have to talk about from where we are now. And I think there has to be people who push further. And mm-hmm. I'm afraid I'm one of those people. So I'm just one of those people. So that's my role, of trying to find ways to push further. So for a while, I left the party thinking that it was actually on the wrong track. But I realized there's different stages all the way along. And now the party, I think, has continued to keep moving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're doing very well with their policy right now.
Oh, good.
Although I still push further
mm-hmm.
myself, but I'm very happy with where they're at.
So if the Green Party did get an in, sort of as leading a certain area, like a province or something, what kind of changes do you think, based on what you know, would they make? Or it's hard to say, I know, as a political party, because you're representing people, but what kind of things would they be looking for, do you think?
Well, definitely they would be trying to create far more local economies.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to work more with the grassroots of various community aspects in order mm-hmm. to create those economies. But of course, they still have to have their foot in the big mainstream economy as well, and that's the very mm-hmm. difficult part, is making that step between the two, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe one of the core things would be to be convincing people that you're not ecological unless you're looking at the whole society.
Mm-hmm.
And all the aspects of the economy and all of the social aspects that make up the civil society. You can never simply just concentrate on the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that impinges on the environment is because of what humans are doing, trying to meet their needs in all those other areas.
Mm-hmm.
So they're totally linked.
Mm-hmm.
And the Green Party...
It's not narrow.
It's not narrow. And
yeah.
People who still think in terms that you save the environment and then we just carry on with our economy,
mm-hmm.
just do not grasp that. And the
mm-hmm.
Green Party, I think the most wonderful role they will have is being able to demonstrate, at least from a perspective of getting the chance to talk about this in the bigger media realm, because if mm-hmm. they were elected on any level, even if it's just a few members of parliament, they'll have a chance to say this and demonstrate more clearly to people that linkage.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be the biggest first gain.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Green Party in other countries, particularly in Europe, I think is having more success. Am I right?
Yes.
Yes.
Definitely have had people in parliament for a far longer time. In Germany,
yeah.
major people have gotten to have slave in the actual government.
Is there a lot of communication across with European parties and kind of modeling, or is there some kind of communication going across?
You know, I'd have to take you back to when I was active in the Green Party,
I guess.
And then there was. We had people from Germany come over. I went to the Green Parliament in Brussels and England, meeting with various Green Party people and going to conferences. And at that time, like I said, the people from Germany came over regularly and we had interaction, but I can't answer that now for what's going on now.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you were leading, were there extra politics surrounding the fact that you were a woman?
It never came up in
no.
anything that I was involved with at the time that was obvious.
Yeah.
I think the party was quite ready to
mm-hmm.
have women at that point and very happy. And still, I would have a hard time to imagine that has shifted. Although I know that I think another woman leader following me did seem to find she was having problems. I mean, reading her reasons for leaving, and a lot of it was to do with that, but I didn't experience that in any way.
Mm-hmm. You've already expressed a kind of a pleasure in how things are going with the party. What are some of the differences between then and now that you can recognize from the outside?
Well, just the fact that they've had so much time to go out and to be talking to people in communities, and also the whole analysis of the ecological crisis has evolved so hugely.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we knew that we were in a crisis. I remember saying to people, we're sliding down a slope in the dark. We don't know when we're going to hit the cliff. And I remember all the analysis we had of the future climate change events that would be terrifying. Mm-hmm. Those are all happening now. Mm-hmm. I thought they were going to happen 100 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And recently I heard David Suzuki say that he, in the 80s, he's also thought that these worst-case scenarios were 100 years away. Mm-hmm. And now they're happening now. So that really changes everything. Suddenly there's a whole new pressure on anybody who's concerned about the environment. And the Green Party has definitely taken that into account. When I listen to the various people I've gone to hear speak,
mm-hmm.
they definitely realize that we really do have to make some clear changes, and it has to happen now. It's not anything political anymore. This is very serious,
mm-hmm.
and they have often expressed anger at the fact that other parties aren't taking it seriously enough, and that's mm-hmm. something that we didn't do in the past as much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a lot more of a push, or more of a kind of a insistence going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's very frightening.
Like a wake up sort of thing.
It's very frightening, especially if people have children, etc.
Yeah.
Adrian Carr gave a wonderful talk down at the library on December mm-hmm. 8th about the fact that when you have children and you think of the future. I don't mm-hmm. have children, but I have nephews and nieces, and I've woken up in the morning with semi nightmares about mm-hmm. what's going to be like in mm-hmm. 40, 50 years.
So now I'd like to, we'll start talking about Global Warming Cafe.
Based on David Gersten's work from New York and the Empowerment Institute, mm-hmm. he actually has been encouraging people to use this format all around North America and Europe. The Global Warming Cafes themselves are based on the World Cafes.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very participatory. And we have evolved our own system because we've now put on 5. And what we do is the first half of the event, we have people come and just talk about their feelings, mm-hmm. their fears, and what encourages them and discourages them, because people don't have an opportunity to talk
mm-hmm.
in that way. I mean, I live my life in two places. One part of my life is with people who are very concerned and aware,
mm-hmm.
and another part is with people who are just almost oblivious to
mm-hmm.
it.
Kind of in our culture.
Yeah.
So
and also with my family and friends.
Yeah.
And so I go to events and I just have to be somewhat quiet because but I'm amazed that people are talking about the future as if there was a normal future ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's incredible that that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always this need to bring myself back to balance, aware of what's happened ahead of us, working hugely hard to get deal with it because that's the one way I keep my sanity,
mm-hmm.
and then also being aware that I'm in a culture where people just are not accepting
mm-hmm.
the reality, and there's all kinds of people sort of aware. So it's in the major milieu of discussion, but it's still a fringe thing. And so with our to have a chance to discuss, it's important for people who have clicked in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we give people that opportunity, and there's people with different levels of expertise at the table, so they learn from each other and just get that chance. And people seem to really love it. Most often people haven't wanted it to end.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do the second half where we then introduce our actions. And we have divided it now into personal, household, political, legislative, and then spiritual, creative.
Mm-hmm.
And I've started introducing the political legislative because I wanted us to really take a little bit of a deeper look at the crisis. I think that maybe part of the problem with why people are not catching on is because there's all kinds of doomsday scenarios out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe because we don't deep enough solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking this may be the problem. I was studying what happened going into the Second World War. Because
mm-hmm.
I had thought I'd do that with part of my project for my master's as an example of what we might do now. And
mm-hmm.
many people have been talking about that now, and I'm still very keen on what we did in the Second World War. And during that period of time, they started in England asking for people to bring in their pots and pans and gate railings. And the underlying understanding, from what I've heard from people from England, is that they really didn't need them at that time. They just wanted to start getting people to realize that it was they were in a difficult situation, and to be prepared for even more sacrifices going on. We are in a difficult situation right now. We don't need anybody to come up with some bogus solution. But we do need, I think, for people to start talking about really heavy solutions. Because then people maybe realize, gee, if we have to go that far, then maybe we better pay attention to this. And so I wanted us to have a little bit stronger solutions. And so lately I've been leading us into the political and legislative action part. And we've had some very good speakers on the other parts as well.
What is the balance of that? Like, I know there's like two ways of going about it. There's the political legislation, and then there's their sort of your own home practice, sort of like inside, from the inside out or from the outside in. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm glad you asked me that question. That's sort of my pet thinking right now. Is we're at a point right now, because we've had these worst case scenarios starting to happen already. The modeling that was supposed to take care of happened a century from now, happening now. I remember in the 80s saying if the permafrost starts to go, you let the methane and exponential growth of greenhouse gases will just let us go into runaway climate change. And that's happening. That's starting to happen now. So we have to be incredibly, incredibly serious about change. And it's not just simply that we have climate change happening far quicker and more threatening than we thought was going to happen. But we're sitting right in the midst of our social justice crisis, which is tied in, global social justice crisis, that's tied in with our overuse of the resources and taking people's lands, etc. Many of the wars that are existing and around the world can be analyzed right back to our resource use of North America and people being disenfranchised from their own land. So we're sitting with that. We're sitting with the peaking not only of oil, but many of our major non-renewable resources that we need to maintain our economy. And we're sitting with biodiversity extinction at an amazing rate. I don't know if amazing is the right word. So we're sitting within three other crises besides climate change. So it's not enough to talk about just reducing our carbon and greenhouse gas footprint. We have to reduce our ecological footprint, which is our general degradation. And people from Bill Rees and people associated with him and the ecological footprint people have said since 1980 we've been taking down our renewables at a rate faster than nature replenishes them. I'm understanding that to mean the balance globally. So since 1980, we've been depleting our world, and that's a collapse in itself. So when we start to talk about how to solve climate change, you can't say business as usual over here, and we'll just tighten up and not use as much energy over here, or we'll use some new energy.
It's a huge change.
It's a total change. It's a total change. And we could say that's impossible. And many people do. I hear people say, well, we have to start with what's politically possible and or economically possible. Don't make us go fast and have the economy collapse. But we have to start what's ecologically needed because everything else is going to go anyway. It's not a choice anymore. And I think that's the hard thing for us to grasp is we need to start looking at what's needed ecologically and then sort through the rest to see what we have.
Now, what about the economy? I often ask myself, is the economy even important, or is that even part of the problem? What are your thoughts?
Economy creates the problem.
Yeah.
It's only been since we've had this economic structure.
Like, I've seen George Bush just recently giving some kind of talk, and he's only talking about the economy, and it just is like watching, you know, it's depressing because that's his only focus, is the economy.
Keep the economy, without recognizing that you can't have an economy if you don't have a planet.
Yeah.
This is a discussion I would love us to have. I would love to find people who want to have the discussion what happens with capitalism? What does capitalism end up like? Mm-hmm. Does it exist? Or what does it become in order to take into account all the new pressures and forces that exist right now in the early part of this century? I don't want to know what capitalism was supposed to look like back when Adam Smith was writing and all of the philosophy that so many people want to grasp and hang on to.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know what mixture of traditional with the way that people used to embed the economy right in their whole lifestyle, the command economies right back to Egypt, which I understand are the best economies for quick change, which brings me back to the war economy. Don't let me go off that. And then the market. Like, how do we muddle all those three together in a way that makes some sense?
Mm-hmm.
Not be ideological. I have to fight myself every day. Am I just taking this from an ideological stand, or am I really trying to look at things? Because it's important not to be ideological. The market has a role, obviously, to some extent, but I would love to talk to some economists. Just sit down and talk and say, okay, well, how does the market have a role when the market, I mean, the market definitely has a role. All through history, we've made our living by focusing, up until the last 200 years, we've made our livings by focusing on meeting our basic needs. And people had time for art, and time to be creative, and time for community. How basic could we make an economy and take care of nature and still have a nice, decent, wonderful way of life, which I believe we could. I really do believe we could, because I've been living basically for the last 30 years to be more and more and more simple. I do not see myself as deprived, even though I don't. I live fairly basically, and I know we could live more basically than that and even be better off. I'd love to be gardening with some people somewhere in a city garden and doing a whole number of other things that were just more mainstream. But going back to the war economy, the war economy is our kind of shining light, because they shifted in months from an economy that was going in one whole
direction. So that is essentially what is interesting to you, is that?
Yes.
Yes.
They shifted it in months. What they did, from what I understand, is when they brought the automobile manufacturers, etc., in to say, we need you to gear up and produce our tanks and whatever else, and the people said, well, I think the different CEOs said that, well, they thought they were going to add that onto car production. And Roosevelt in the States said, no, you don't understand. There's not going to be any cars produced during this time. And they did that with many luxury items. I'd love to know how much the different parties worked together, the different government, how many people worked in the government from different parties, because I'm assuming they drew from everybody they could to deal with it. The other part I do know about is that they did set up committees with bureaucrats and businessmen to figure out how to balance the use of resources. They now had gone from a depression to people working with money, and they didn't want them buying all the luxuries because they would take away the resources they needed for the war. We now have the opposite. We have dwindling resources that are being used to build gidgety gadgets that we basically throw away regularly, huge houses we don't need, a huge amount of cars we don't need. We have so many things we don't need, and our economy's focused that way. Now we need to focus on all the things we really do need, alternative energies, windmills, etc., etc. Maybe buying up land in cities for urban gardens. We need people to come together to talk about how do you do that and protect those resources. And that's where the market is a problem, and economists should be discussing, I think. Okay, so we can't just let the market be loose. We can't just let anybody come in and develop any little gidgety gadget they want. We have things we specifically need, and we need to create a way of having an economy that focuses around that. And they did it in the war. They did it very quickly in the war, and we could do it again if we had political will.
Yeah. And what do you think does it take to get that will?
It's going to take people understanding.
Yeah.
So there's where the wicked circle goes, because people don't understand. We don't have enough discussion in the media. Much of the media is owned by the larger corporations, so they're not going to discuss that if it seems threatening. I think there's a huge number of people in corporations who do care and would make the shift, and even they probably aren't getting enough information. Others of them are probably sitting in rooms and hearing about it and hearing about climate change and getting very concerned. So I'm sure there's a huge mixed bag happening out there. But to get citizens aware enough that they start demanding that these changes go ahead. Because I think the problem is that there's going to be a lot of people who are powerful and they love the status quo and they have the power, and until we really push, I don't see how the change can happen.
So this is being Catherine Cholette, and we are on Sustainable Futures. All right, thank you.
Thank you, too.
Okay.
Great, that was awesome, Ryan.
Yeah, and that was awesome, Catherine.
Well done, well done. Fair play to you. Coming up next, Sarah Hyde has done an interview with Ali Turnbull of the BC Cooperative Association, and they talked about a couple of really cool things in there, how to engage youth in environmental issues, and then they also spoke about the conference that they just put on this year and how they prevented over 300,000 kilograms of carbon from being emitted into the atmosphere, which I think is just, that's huge for an organization to do that.
It's walking the talk.
I think that the way that they went about organizing the Building Cooperative Futures Conference so as to include people from all over the world was really, really innovative. I thought that it was really cool.
And that connects with youth very well. One thing that I'm noticing when it comes to sustainability initiatives, when it's something that's put together by younger people compared to when it's something that's put together by older people, the things that are put together by younger people tend to be a lot more walking the talk than those that come from generations before. And it's just habits of sustainability. It's being able to walk the talk, because when I think people are older, they often don't entirely get the whole of the concept because they've grown up for so long in a different way of thinking.
Hi, I'm Sarah Hyde, and today I'm talking to Ali Turnbull of the British Columbia Cooperative Association. The BCCA is on a quest to help young people be better global citizens, and this means, among other things, living in an environmentally responsible way. They have a lot of youth involvement in the organization, and that's what we're going to talk about. First thing I'm going to get you to do is, could you introduce yourself?
So my name is Ali Turnbull, and I run the youth programs at the BC Cooperative Association. BCCA works with this sort of idea of trying to put together a vibrant cooperative economy in the province, and having a social economy as well. So really working towards more sustainable communities, less corporate power and more community power, more communities having control over local assets.
All right. And how do co-ops overlap with sort of a sustainable mandate and an environmental mandate?
Well, I think that the big push that we're seeing now is a need to relocalize. So looking at reducing our consumption and also sourcing what we need from our local environment. So in terms of things like food security, rather than bringing in food from far away, it's looking at what we can actually produce locally and looking at ways that we can actually just consume less and be less demanding on the environment. So co-ops really, I think, answer to this a lot, because instead of this idea that, you know, we have large corporations that dominate the scene and either in terms of agriculture have big monocrops that grow mass amounts of wheat all over the landscape, it's looking at more local community control. So if you think of sort of a food co-op or a farming co-op, it's owned by multi-stakeholders rather than being owned by investors that are just looking for profit and return. Instead, there can be more care given to what the local needs are, and the community members are the people that the workers or the co-op is responsible to and accountable to, rather than kind of the investors, which is just can cause a lot of problems.
So you recently had a conference, a youth conference about cooperatives in Vancouver, and I'm wondering how this sort of environmental mandate played out in the conference planning.
So the conference is an annual conference that has been running since 2003. It's called Building Cooperative Futures. And this year I worked, so the BCCA, myself from BCCA, and a woman from the BC Institute of Cooperative Studies, we worked together to redesign the way that the conference would take place. And we called it Building Cooperative Futures in a Carbon Neutral World. So, you know, the idea was to really make sure that people weren't getting on planes and coming flying across the world for what has been a 3 or 4 day event. So in this way, we got a lot more people involved.
involved. You know, we've got 16 groups of young people in Argentina and areas in South America. They came together, so 16 different farmer and agricultural co-ops, and they each had several representatives, came to one place in Buenos Aires, and then they all had a chance to talk about, you know, the things that they're facing and the reality of the co-op movement down there. And then they were able to share with us, and we were able to ask them questions. It was really amazing. And we estimated that by pursuing the web-based opportunity, by using this instead of air travel, the conference avoided producing more than 300,000 kilograms of carbon dioxide and putting that into the atmosphere.
So I have a question. As somebody who works with young people around these sorts of issues, what do you think are the particular strengths that young people bring to this area?
Well, it was really great. In the Vancouver Regional Forum, we had young people aged, say, between sort of 15, 16, up into 30, and maybe even a few older than 30, come together and talk about all the different concerns and projects that these young people are involved in to look at food and fair trade and all sorts of issues of, you know, where we are in the world. And it was really inspiring to hear how young people are really inheriting this earth. You know, we've used that term again and again, you know, it'll be the grandchildren or it'll be the children who inherit the earth. And now we're at that place where it's like, here they are, you know, these young people really aware of the environmental issues from an early age and aware of, you know, the imbalances of power in the world.
What are the suggestions you have to youth who are interested in getting involved?
Our organization, the BC Cooperative Association, we're just in a stage where we're looking at a project around parkland stewardship opportunities.
And if people are interested in getting involved with that, how should they contact, or like, where can they go online?
So if they go online to the BC Cooperative website, it's www.bcca.coop. There's contact information there for either myself at the BC Cooperative Association or the executive director here, John Rostakis, and they can either send an email or give us a phone call and just ask us about the project. We are at very kind of beginning stages, but we're really interested to hear ideas from young people. We're looking at two different areas in BC to do a sort of feasibility study and look at what this will look like and how we can help engage young people in stewarding for the natural, or stewardship of the natural parklands.
Brilliant. And what if young people are interested in building skills so that they can start their own movements, be them environmental or not, in their own communities?
Well, we have a great leadership program that we run through the summer. They're called the Yes Camps. They're for young people between ages 14 and 17 years old. So if there are young people who are in that age group, our leadership camps are fantastic. And we cover all sorts of different skill building workshops around leadership, self-awareness, communication skills, and cooperative values. And we run week-long retreats in the summer in beautiful wilderness settings on the island, on Vancouver Island. So that's a way for young people to get involved and meet other inspired young people in the community and get some really tangible skills. And for people older than that,
Good luck.
All sorts of organizations.
It's true. And in terms of the camps, is there any sort of environmental education that goes on at the camps?
Well, we have partnered up with the Mountain Equipment Co-op over the last 5 years to bring more kind of wilderness education into the program, and we're still looking at developing that. We definitely do some, like, global citizenship and awareness workshops. They're called the Yes Camp, which is Youth Excellence Society. And yeah, there's lots of information on the website, and people can apply online there.
Awesome. If you're interested in getting involved in the BCCA or Camp Yes, make sure you check out those sites. There are lots of sponsorships available for the camp program, so don't worry about the money. Just get in touch with Allie. And thank you, Allie, for taking the time to talk to me. I'm Sarah Hyde.
Great, so they're doing some really wonderful things, Ryan.
I like that there's a lot on this episode about cooperative action. Working as a community with common interests makes things a lot more fun.
Yeah, I think so. It's not just about theories, though, and actually talking about concepts and whatnot. These are actually groups that are doing it and mm-hmm. who are on the ground doing this work, getting people together, and promoting sustainability.
Yes, and in groups, I think energy can really build upon itself. Whereas an individual might have a hard time getting motivated by motivating himself, they can see other people excited about things and get more excited by just being in that.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you 100%, Ryan, because you know what? Whenever I go to Green Drinks every month, which is the third Wednesday of every month at Steamworks down in Gastown, every time I go there, every single month, and I see so many people doing so many cool things for the environment, it inspires me to keep doing this show and to keep doing other things for sustainability and the environment. So definitely, group power, power to ya.
Cheers to all you groupies out there. Next up is an interview with Zoe Blunt of Wild Earth, which is also group action, but it's direct action activism. And this is a group that is an activist training camp, which I thought was really cool. I never heard of anything like that before.
No, I haven't either, actually.
So here's what she had to say. So this is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures speaking with Zoe Blunt of Wild Earth. We are going to be learning about the fine organization. First of all, where did Wild Earth originate from?
The Wild Earth is conceived, I guess, in 1998 here in Victoria. This is a few years after the Clackwood Sound protests. People may remember the mass protest to preserve the Clackwood Sound rainforest on Vancouver Island. The mass arrests, almost 1,000 people were arrested. And in the wake of all that, there was a real need. People felt there was a need to continue teaching and learning about campaigns and protests and defending the land, doing things like blockades and civil disobedience and teaching about nonviolence. So it was conceived as a sort of an activist training camp, and that's what we've been doing. The first gathering was in 1999. We're planning our 10th gathering for 10 years now, probably in Bella Coola at the end of August this year. And we're going to be doing more of the same, sharing skills and networking and carrying on with the tradition of preserving rainforests in British Columbia.
Is this for all of BC or is it Victoria, Vancouver Island?
People come from all over. We've had people come from as far away as England and Tasmania, and lots of people come from Ontario and across British Columbia. We really work on making it inclusive, mm-hmm. and we have it in a different location every year, so Wild Earth has been all over the province just about. We haven't spent as much time in the interior as we have on the coast, and I think that's mainly just because most of the organizers live on the coast and now on Vancouver Island, and there's a real history of activism here that we get to tap into. There's a lot of, it's not the same as it was 10 years ago. We don't see nearly as much action in civil disobedience and really frontline, no compromise rainforest preservation. And that's really unfortunate, but I think we're carrying forward the tradition here. We're passing it on to the next generation. I think that it's coming back. I think there's going to be a big upswing in people prepared to put it on the line, and say we're losing so much of our rainforest now. We're losing so much of the old growth forest, and it really hasn't slowed down much since the days of Clackwood, and it's probably speeded up. And we're even losing old growth forests in Clackwood Sound still. They're taking out barge loads of cedar, mm-hmm. and this is not the future that we envisioned for British Columbia 10 years ago. It's not the future that people want now. So we're doing it now we've been organizing on Vancouver Island, but we're going to be taking it to the mainland and taking it up to Bella Coola, and we'll see where it goes from there next year.
Well, this sounds very exciting. I think it's a great idea. And I was wondering, how do people get involved then if people listening right now want to really get some activist training? They really want to get involved, but they're really not sure how do they get involved?
The best way to reach us is by email and on our website, and that's wildearth2008.blogspot.com. Folks can also Google Wild Earth Rendezvous or Wild Earth Training Camp and find us that way. It's a sliding scale, so it's like people pay what they can for our week-long campout, and that's the highlight of the year. We have a week-long campout. We do all these workshops and have all these sessions, and we sit around the campfire, and it's really great. But we don't have a big budget. You know, it's very grassroots. We get a little bit of funding. Mostly it's just what people can donate, so we don't have a big budget for advertising. You know, there won't be any full-page newspaper ads. People find out about it mostly from community radio, actually, and by internet and word of mouth and the emails that I send out. So folks can get in touch and ask to be put on the email list, and we'll be sending directions and coordinating with rides, and probably rent a couple of school buses this year to go up to Bella Coola, meet with the Newhawk First Nation. We've been invited by the House of Smayusta, and they have some real concerns about logging and environmental degradation on the Central Coast and in the Great Barrier Rainforest. So that'll be a really great opportunity for people to learn about what's really happening on the ground up there, what's really happening in the forest, and sort of get beyond the hype.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Zoe.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.
So that was Zoe Blunt. And now for our weekly features, the Streeters and the Environmental News Update.
We're here at the Kitsilano Farmers Market today. Why did you decide to come here today?
Because I've never been here before, and I should have been here before this because I don't live that far away, and I just thought I'd check it out. It's great.
And that's exactly the same for me. I had some time, and everybody's talking about it, and I saw the sign down there, and I'm a Kitsilano. I've lived here all my life. You know, I live in the area, so I just parked my car in the shade and walked over, and it's amazing.
First impressions?
Oh, it's terrific. It's a little bit of everything, and the music is great. I haven't eaten any of the food yet, but I think I might get a little something to take home.
Some tasty treats here.
Uh-huh. My first impression is it's way, way more than I thought it was. I just thought it was going to be a couple of stalls with, you know, a few produce, you know, trucks and stuff brought in. So I had no idea it was like this.
What does it mean to you to be able to buy local food?
Oh, it's really important. Absolutely, yeah, there's no question. I live in Granville Island, so I shop in the market there. But I try to only buy locally. I mean, as much as I can.
Yeah, same here. The Barbara Kingsolver's book, it was just shocking. Like, the average orange you eat has traveled about 10,000 miles.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
You've used up tons of petroleum, as well as all the fertilizers that go into non-organic materials. It's all oil-based. I wasn't aware that, you know, you don't really think about it, right? You just go
and grow bananas, you grab,
yeah, of course. and as they were saying, too, that the locally produced stuff might not look as good, but the reason that the strawberries are so red and the apples are so perfect is because they're it's all chemically induced stuff, and we as a culture don't want to buy a slightly bruised banana. We want them all to be perfectly yellow. We want the strawberries to be perfectly red, and for that we're taking a lot of chemicals into our system, I think.
How do you think a farmer's market contributes to the sustainability of Vancouver, to a city?
Well, I think if all this stuff really is from within 50 miles around, that's going to certainly help, you know, just create that kind of sustainability market as opposed to this world market where we're getting whatever from wherever and it's costing, you know, the planet a lot to bring that stuff to us.
It just feels really, really good. I mean, I was born in the 40s, you know, and they used to have square dancing in the park in the 50s, and this has that same kind of folksy feeling that's so lacking in the modern world.
Yeah, no, true. That's,
it's fantastic.
You know, the Safeway, it's all so cold and indifferent and what it is. And this is just real funky and friendly, and people seem to be smiling a lot in here. They're not rushing to get to the cash register, lining up, and it's just a different, completely different experience.
How long have you been coming out to the farmers markets?
Probably 3 years.
How have you seen it grow over those past 3 years?
A lot more producers, more farmers, and different organizations and companies are joining every year.
And why do you like coming out to the farmers market?
I like to support the local farmers and also to get fresh and more, I guess, real produce, something tastes delicious and not just factory made.
Right. So you notice the difference between stuff you buy here and stuff you buy at perhaps some other giant chain of stores?
Yep, a huge difference. It tastes a lot different, and I feel better about buying it because I can talk to the producers and see exactly how they farm, what they do, their practices, and how they treat their animals and things like that.
How do you think a farmer's market contributes to the sustainability of a community?
Well, I mean, everything's local, so you don't have to have things brought in by trucks. You know where it's produced. You know the laws of the local area around you, so you can tell how the practices are done.
I'm here with two musicians.
Fraser River Ramblers.
How long have you guys been playing at the farmer's market?
Well, this is my first time here, but I think Morgan's been here a couple times. Huh?
This is my second. I did the West End 2 weekends ago, and this is the first time here at the Kitsilano.
Can you describe the atmosphere here at the farmer's market?
I've seen mostly smiles. I'd say 95% smiles, and a couple of the children in the strollers were crying. So, yeah. But, I mean, they probably were hungry or they're tired. But in general, it's well received.
This is Kitsilano, Vancouver, at its finest. At its just great food. The weather is fantastic. And, of course, the quality and standard of the food here is just to die for. So
Second to none.
Just great stuff.
What's your favorite part of the farmer's market?
The berries, the strawberries, the raspberries. But, of course, for us, it's an opportunity to bring our music and go out and meet people. And this is really the best way for me to connect with the community and with people.
What's your favorite part of the market?
Well, I think the organic produce is great. I mean, you know, usually there's only one variety or one store that you can go to, and it's nice that you can go to each booth and they all have their own sort of representation. It's very nice. I mean, it's good to have the choices.
What do you guys think about it?
It's very good.
It's very good. Are you talking about the crepe or the farmer's market? And now for this week's environmental news update.
One of SFU's newest buildings has won a prestigious building award for its environmentally conscious management and design. The Building Owners and Managers Association of British Columbia awarded the Arts and Social Sciences Complex the Earth Award for its use of green construction materials and environmental systems. The building features an underground reservoir that can hold more than 227,000 liters of rainwater for irrigation. Infrared sensors inside the building can shut off air conditioning and lighting in low traffic areas. The Building Owners and Managers Association give the annual award to buildings that use innovative environmental building design and green building materials. SFU was also recognized as the first Canadian educational institution to achieve the association's Go Green certification. First, it was the carbon tax, and soon a cap and trade system will be implemented to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. According to a draft report released on Wednesday, the Western Climate Initiative plans to implement the regional cap-and-trade system on January 1, 2012. After this, the program will be phased in gradually over a period of 8 years. The coalition is aiming to cut greenhouse gas emissions to 15% below 2005 levels by 2020. BC, Manitoba, Quebec, and most recently Ontario are partners in the Western Climate Initiative, along with California and 6 other U.S. states. Ontario is now the 4th Canadian province to join the Western Climate Initiative. With Ontario's new partner status, the 4 provinces now represent 2/3 of Canada's population and 73% of Canada's economy. And in international news, an environmental campaign is now underway in Thailand. The Plant for the Planet, Plant for the Future campaign was launched at the opening of the Sirintorn International Environment Park. The plan is to plant almost 300,000 tree species in this new park to protect forests for future generations. The Thai campaign is currently overseen by the United Nations Environment Programme's Billion Tree Campaign. And if personal health isn't a good enough reason to go on a diet, here's another one. It's good for the planet and the economy. Researchers from Cornell University studied the amount of consumption in the food system and found that Americans could easily decrease energy demands by half by altering the way they eat and produce food. On average, an American will consume 3,747 calories per day. That's about 1,747 more calories than recommended. It takes about 2,000 liters of oil per person per year, or 19% of total energy use in the U.S. to produce this many calories on a daily basis. Going vegetarian is one way to reduce the amount of energy consumed by food production. The researchers estimated that half of the energy used to produce food in the U.S. is used to produce meat products. the researchers also suggested that reducing the distance food travels from the source to the consumer's mouth will also decrease energy consumption. And that was your weekly environmental news update. So that brings our show to a close. Thanks to Catherine Collette, Zoe Blunt, the Fraser River Ramblers,
Sarah Hyde,
and Allie Turnbull for sharing their perspectives today.
So I hope you enjoyed listening as much as we have enjoyed putting this together for you.
And we leave you now with some more music from the Fraser River Ramblers.
And we are wishing you
a sustainable future.
I was born in Macon, Georgia. Killed my dad in the Macon jail. My daddy said, son, keep your hands clean, and you won't hear them bloodhounds on the trail. I wash my hands in muddy water.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. We are also available on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. And if you want any information, you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.